Let's talk about the world most hated. Bin Laden and terrorists may be exaggerated. So what you see on the news is fabricated. True told, spit facts, now let me elaborate it. Before you knew about September 11, Osama bin Laden, born 1957 in Riyadh.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett. Today, I'm going to be playing the final half hour of my interview with Dr. Michael Brenner. He's a professor emeritus of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh and a fellow in transatlantic relations at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about his article on the lies about the death of bin Laden. Then in the second half of the show, I will be doing a half an hour with Ole Domegaard on the CIA-linked Operation 40 assassination ring. So here we go, cutting in to the interview with Dr. Michael Brenner. You know, there's a lot more we could talk about, including, you know, you talked about contradictions in the U.S. becoming the air force of al-Qaeda in Yemen, and of course the contradiction of the U.S. supposedly just going and killing bin Laden and throwing his body in the ocean, or was it out of a helicopter with no attempt to identify it?
Yeah. Let me just say a couple of things on that.
Okay, we only have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, very quickly on that one. I was told by a former very senior intelligence official in the U.S., you know, just below the top at one point, that he had been told by an old contact in the CIA 4 years ago. He told me this 4 years ago about the walk-in. So the walk-in is totally undeniable. Because now they've admitted it, that there was a walk-in. We're trying to finesse it by saying, yeah, there was a walk-in, but the information wasn't critical. Yeah, you have a former high official of the ISI walking into the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, and all he wants to talk about was help setting up a kebab restaurant in Washington. I mean, you know, but this is the line which the mainstream media have.
Give me a kebab restaurant and I'll hand you bin Laden's head on a platter.
I mean, that's the line which has been accepted now by NBC. In the walk back, if you like. Okay. Two, it seems now, and I also have some very good contacts in Pakistan and even, you know, former military people. There's all of this we'll never get all the details on. Two, the Obama double-crossing of the Pakistani leaders is a fact. In other words, when they told us about bin Laden, and we never found him, at the end they admitted they had him after the walk-in, right? The plan was, as Cy Hirsch outlines, that they didn't want this to come out. So the plan was to claim he'd been killed in an airstrike in the Hindu Kush. In other words, they were going to kill him in a Abbottabad, get out of there, nobody would ever know about it, and then the announcement would come for the killing. Obama, for political reasons, stabbed Pakistani leaders in the army in the back. Whatever you think of the Pakistani army leaders, right? And they paid a very heavy price, and they barely survived. And this also had a damaging effect on our operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's another thing. So the implication, three, the whole mythical story about the CIA, of which, you know, Zero Dark 30 is the cartoon version. Let's just talk about the official version, right? It's pure myth. It's pure myth and was concocted after the fact, right? Because, and Hirsch is good on this, in order to make Obama's precipitate action comprehensible. Mm-hmm. And fourth, I'm also told that, you know, the famous picture of the president and his cabinet watching the raid on a television screen with Hillary's chin in her hand was posed. They lost the feed and they created this posed photo op afterwards.
Right. And that's standard operating procedure, just like the leaders leading the Charlie Hebdo march in Paris.
I mean, yeah. In other words, it's gotten so bad that some of these characters, like a real narcissist, for clinical reasons, find it just as not more natural to deceive and lie than to tell the truth.
And given that, do you think it's possible that the Hirsch version is itself something of a limited hangout? Many people believe that Bin Laden died in 2001. Is that possible?
No. He's Hirsch basically had, from everything I've heard from you know, people like I mentioned in Washington and in Pakistan, he basically has it right. You also have to know Cy Hirsch. You know, he's a very strong-willed now, some sort of crotchety guy, and he doesn't give a damn what people think.
Well, why is it then that when he reported that he had a high-level intelligence source right after 9/11 admitting that all of the evidence implicating the 19 guys was planted, it was quote-unquote left for a trail left for the FBI to chase, that is the planted so-called Muhammad Atta suitcase, ludicrously badly forged so-called last will and testament written by an Islam specialist who didn't know the first thing about Islam, even botched the Bismillah. You know, you can't make up how bad it is. So Hirsch reported that, and then he just dropped it. Okay, so all of the evidence against the 19 guys was forged and left,
but
he just lets it go.
You know, who knows? But Hirsch will not bend to pressure. And from what I'm told by a friend of his, who's a friend of mine in Washington, he gets his information very close to the top. Where he gets it from are disgruntled senior military and intelligence people who have a certain integrity and conscience. They're in their 50s. They've gone as far as they can go. And they just want some of these things to get out. That's where he gets his information.
Well, we get a lot of that stuff at Veterans Today, and Wade Manson gets it from people,
too.
Well,
he also talks,
we're only as good as our sources.
You know, he also talks to other people, obviously. So
I think he usually gets it right, but I wouldn't just have faith.
Yeah, but see, this is one reason, logically, why he has to be somewhat, assuming that he is, has to be somewhat selective and discriminating. Because if he loses the confidence that those people, not just the same people, but people like them have, that he's not going to do anything to expose them, then he loses his sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that how it always is? And you know, the so-called dissident left, the Nation magazine and all those folks, as Marty Schatz pointed out in his book History Will Not Absolve Us about the JFK assassination, that you know they have a nice place at the table. They can have their cake and eat it too. They can salve their consciences and make a nice living. But if they tell the truth about the JFK assassination or 9/11 or a whole lot of other things like that, they're not going to lose their place at the table. They're turning over the table.
You know, well, but you could say that about Hirsch's sources or people at that level. I don't think you can say that about Hirsch.
Well, you why won't
he
follow up the fact
lavishly
that all of the evidence implicating the 19 alleged hijackers was planted?
Well, that I don't know anything about. Look, a guy like Cy Hirsch.
Google his name and the phrase "left for the FBI to chase," and you'll find it.
Yeah, but a guy like Cy Hirsch could have made a hell of a lot more money, could have achieved much more fame and fortune, right, than he has, if he were really prepared to sell out, other than simply basing his own actions on his own best judgment as to how I can best get stories like this out over time. Look, you got to give the guy, you know what things were like when he broke the My Lai story?
Mm-hmm. Well, at that time, the New York Times would cover that kind of thing.
Well, yes, I mean, but he did it. You know what, but that wasn't easy, I can tell you, I can tell you that, because I was alive at the time. See, you gotta give the guy credit. By the way, you know who a junior officer was who wrote the first cover-up of My Lai?
Wasn't it Colin Powell?
Yes.
Yeah, he's been kind of covering up the sins of his colleagues for quite some time, hasn't he?
He was then involved in covering up the even worse crimes of this Air Force general, I think his name was Donaldson, who in Vietnam at the end introduced and imposed on the Mekong Delta the strategy of simply strafing anyone wearing a black outfit in the fields, and use the tactic in the rice paddies, fly as low as you can. If anybody runs, kill them, because their running means they're Viet Cong. And it became so egregious that even this Air Force general came into scrutiny. And I don't know, you know, all these internal Army Air Force mechanisms. I don't know what the hell they are. But anyway, an officer involved in that was also Colin Powell. This was a few years later.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well,
where did you read about the Powell? Because it's not, it's in the Terse book.
Yeah.
In the Terse book, isn't it?
I think so. And it's also that fact has made the alternative media, particularly when Powell was selling the invasion of Iraq to the United Nations, there were quite a few people who remembered this and said, here he is yet again, you know, pimping for these war criminals.
You see, again, you know, Powell is a dangerous type because, you know, he's the go-along careerist who makes all this possible.
Right. And in that, he's really a symbol of a huge number of people because...
Oh, of course.
Pretty much of course. All
most
of them.
Most people these days.
Yeah.
And not only in government. You see him in the universities. You see him everywhere.
Yeah, it's very sad. Well, here's where, you know, we've already gone over our time limit, so we might as well just enjoy ourselves here. you know, this is where I would argue that the death of religion in Western civilization has entailed the death of religious-based morality, and, you know, that basically law is only law if it's sacred. Mm. There's no such thing as secular law. If it's just secular, then you have to judge it yourself and violated if it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So the Islamic world actually is coming in with a real alternative in the sense of a somewhat more streamlined and workable religion that fits in with people who are more logical. You know, it's not a belief in crazy things. So I think Islam is a challenging Western civilization in a sense, because if you look at Islamic leaders, you know, we have a huge crisis of leadership in the Islamic world, just like in the Western world. But we also do have a number of leaders who at least have a commitment to trying to do good, whether it's, Hezbollah and Iran, I would say, are in the lead of this tendency. But you see bits and pieces of it all over the place. So that leads to the question of whether this so-called war on terror and this so-called clash of civilizations might be partly based on the justified fear that a decadent Western civilization is going to be losing out to the other part of Western civilization that we always say is non-Western, which is the Islamic side of it.
Yeah, but I think you're giving too much credit to our people at the top in terms of their sophistication.
Maybe so.
You know, one of the stunning things is if you meet any of these people, I haven't met any presidents or anything like that, never know, and you realize they're just people. With all the limitations, I mean, they're really extraordinary people, are rare. I mean, I think Obama is the oddest character who's probably ever been in the White House. I actually did a psychological portrait of him.
Really? No? Now, I don't recall reading that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Ursula Dyer. I did a monograph on narcissistic public personalities, which he did not initially figure, and then I wrote something on him. I can send it to you. I mean, that man is weird, but let's not get into that.
Well, how about Bush sending naked self-portraits of himself to his sister?
but he's... The clinical narcissists are a very definite type, and I identified two clinical narcissists. One is Bill Clinton, and the other is Nicolas Sarkozy. Mm-hmm. But then you get this gray area of what they call, what the psychiatrists call, what is it again? Anyway, it's people who behave like narcissists, but the inner psychological deep-seated mainspring is not there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whose whole behavior pattern and attitude is narcissistic, but it is not keyed by whatever is off, you know, in the brain, mind, and so forth. And there I put Bush and Tony Blair. Because when I wrote this, all these guys were in power. And I don't think Obama is a clinical narcissist. He's much more a sort of condensation of the self-centered, particular version of the self-centered type, which is so pervasive these days. But his behavior has become increasingly narcissistic. And one of the symptoms is that at a conscious level, cease to differentiate between actual and virtual reality. And the virtual reality is shaped by their own totally self-absorbed egocentrism. You probably run into people like that. At a certain point, it's not that they're consciously lying, although there's a fine line, obviously, but no longer even recognize it. At least at some level. And I put him in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that.
Now, unlike Hillary, who is just the garden variety egomaniac.
Yeah, yeah.
She's not enough. Because she knows that she's lying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is kind of a control freak, a power-hungry control
freak.
Yeah, but
she's a... See, Bill is a narcissist. She isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not that one is better than the other. by the way, a behavioral tip-off, is Bill Clinton's notorious temper tantrums. Did you read about them?
But doesn't Hillary have temper tantrums too?
No. Not getting angry, not letting off steam. But temper tantrums like a six-year-old child, as have been described, and without any kind of reasonable justification or trigger, you know, a huge gap between whatever prompts it and the actual tantrum,
right,
is like a six-year-old, not all six-year-olds, but you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That you only see in clinical narcissists. You see it in Sarkozy. That was one of the tip-offs for me. I got help from a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist back in Pittsburgh and with some things. But he's Sarkozy, actually, you could use it as an exhibit in a classroom, even more obvious than Bill. Yeah. See, but Hillary is just a bitch, right? Whatever you want to call her, I mean.
Is that label accepted clinically by the American Psychological Association?
Well, these days, after that last farcical, you know, rewriting of their manual. That, by the way, is quite a story I got interested in. Fascinating story.
Really? You know, because what you're mentioning about these political figures reminds me of Lobosuski's book, Political Ponerology, which stimulated a lot of discussion about psychopathy in power, and he claims that it's contagious. So people with these kinds of traits, he talks mainly about psychopathy, but of course narcissism is closely related, that these people...
Well, the behavior, I think, can... Mm-hmm. You see, once you model behavior, extreme behavior, and it becomes accepted, and you can get away with it. At some level, consciously or not, it encourages others.
Right.
Or it creates an environment in which you're... I mean, one thing it can do is it can create an environment in which your garden variety egomaniac, of which, of course, public life is full of, like Hillary, begin to behave narcissistically because it's advantageous. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even though the underlying psychology is not that of a true narcissist. I mean, the things that people can get away with today in public, I mean, it's just extraordinary. I don't know whether you're old enough to remember Richard Nixon.
Oh, sure, yeah. He was my anti-hero when I was a
Now, Richard Nixon was one of the great liars of the 20th century. But Richard Nixon was the lousiest liar, one of the lousiest liars, too, in the sense that he had none of this narcissistic ability to sublimate. So Richard Nixon would get up there, you know, at a press conference or something, and his jaw would sort of tighten. There'd be certain creases would appear, slight little beads of sweat on his brow, and everybody knew Richard Nixon is about to lie.
Would you buy a used car from this man?
And it wasn't just that people were more attentive to lying at that time, although that's partly true as well, but, you know, he just telegraphed it, right? These guys today, like Obama, I mean, I'm convinced.
They lie like they breathe.
Yeah. I'm really fascinated by Obama because he is. I don't find him interesting as a man, as a thinker, and so forth, but I find him as a peculiar embodiment of so many contemporary socio-psychological pathologies. That's what intrigues me about the guy. And in some sense, he's the most dishonest president we've ever had, since he's not honest with himself either. Which is, you know, he does live in a fantasy world. But, and that's also narcissistic. Well, again, I don't think he's a clinical narcissist. Okay, I'm convinced you could get Barack Obama into a room for a polygraph test, right? And you could confront him with the most obvious lies, right? And, you know, he's all hooked up, and you say, did you or did you not? And he would say, you know, no. The needle wouldn't budge.
Well, that, a lot of psychopaths can do that.
Yeah, but, you know, what's interesting, though, is he's not, I don't think of him as a psychopath. I think of him as a sort of extreme expression of certain personality traits and types. But the result is the same in terms of the capacity to lie. Know what I mean?
In the yeah, absolutely. And the political machine seems to have manufactured him that way.
Yeah, well, he's manufactured himself. He began manufacturing himself when he was in college.
And the question is, though, did he have some help? You know, I don't know if you've read Tarpley's alternative biographies of Obama, but it appears that there were some interesting moments. For instance, he was a Russian major at Columbia, and he kind of disappeared during his senior year. The head of the Russian program at that time was Brzezinski, and nobody remembered seeing Obama. Even his roommate never saw him during that year. And then his first job out of college was for a CIA front. So you kind of have to wonder to what extent he's been helped along the way.
Maybe
every time he ran for something, people would die or a scandal.
Maybe he was just surfing in Hawaii.
Yeah.
But let me just, one last word. Now, compared to Obama, if Richard Nixon walked into the polygraph room, before he was seated in the chair and hooked up, the needle would start to move.
Pretty much.
You see, now, in a certain way, that's why I prefer the world of the Nixons to the world of the Obamas.
Yeah, well, in retrospect, Nixon doesn't look so bad in a lot of ways. Well, but Bush was a bad liar too, though, wasn't he?
If you juxtapose Nixon's record in actions and policies and declarations next to Obama's, he is to the left of Obama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, this you can think about. On all kinds of domestic issues, he's well to the left of Obama.
Right.
Environmental issues, what do they call that? The tax credit for the poor, he supported the Clean Air Act.
At some point, he supported the minimum income, I recall.
Yeah, that's what I meant. That was Pat Moynihan pushing him.
Yeah.
And he, even on civil liberties, he never would have dared to do some of the things Obama. Obama authorizing the CIA to hack the computers of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee?
Right.
That's what Obama... Nixon would never dare do that.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Well, I think it's symptomatic of the trend in the overall culture. Although I think there have been tendencies to sort of mass manufacture people with these personality traits, especially sort of shamelessness, psychopathy, perhaps a loyalty only to their fellow ruling elite people.
Yeah.
I mean, their elites are already like that, and then they figured out ways to...
No capacity for empathy.
Exactly.
Of course, the saddest thing is once it becomes so deeply entrenched, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, these attitudes just become commonplace and perpetuate. I see that around the university all the time.
Right.
I mean, 90% of the faculty have been whatever into these kinds of behavior patterns and ways of thinking.
Right. Well, I think initiations into certain kinds of groups intensify it. Skull and Bones being a classic example where these future elitists are made to lie in a coffin naked and masturbate in front of their fellow bonesmen. I mean, anybody who can, and then recite their entire sexual histories, anybody who does that is probably going to come out of that without the kinds of normal behavioral constraints and emotional constraints that govern ordinary people. Just like the gangsters who go out and kill somebody to make their bones. Or
do you have any daughters?
No, I don't. I have two sons.
Can you imagine your daughter marrying one of those guys?
Yeah, I wouldn't let my daughter marry a bonesman, that's for sure.
Although, and well, I don't know what's bleaker, the outlook for American politics or the outlook for the Milwaukee Brewers.
I don't know, but we're going to have to skip the Milwaukee Brewers, partly because I haven't paid attention to them since I was in high school and Hank Aaron was hitting his last home runs, and partly because I think we've reached the end of our special extended interview with Michael Brenner. Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate the kind of truth-telling that you do, and I'd love to have you back again somewhere down the line.
I'd love to. Good speaking with you.
Okay.
Supplied the guns, supplied the recruits, and taught the urban terrorism.
So he wasn't a bad guy, he was an ally.
Yeah, the U.S. even recruited for Al-Qaeda right here in the States, and sent them more fighters, recruited at the Al-Qaeda Refugee Center in New York. And then they were sent to Virginia to Camp Perry, the CIA training facility, taught sabotage skills and pillar military techniques. And this program was called Operation Cyclone, and kept in the doors. And when you see Ben Laden holding his AK, just remember that he worked for CIA and would attack, bomb, kill or shoot whoever the United States wanted them to. So now the U.S. can secretly attack a nation through the use of the Al-Qaeda Foundation. They got $6 billion from me and you between 1978 and 92. And in May 2001, the Secretary of State gave them $43 million in aid. There's a game being played that's easy to lose, especially when you don't even know the rules. It's funny how the U.S. trained the terrorists to fight and defend against the Soviets, but then 2003 did the same thing. I hope you understand the game being played. You can't believe everything you see, everything you hear.
Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing on guests telling various truths that you're not going to hear much in the corporate-controlled mainstream. Well, now we're going to bring on somebody who's taken the full red pill, and that is Ole Domegaard. Ole Domegaard got started researching the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and he spent much of the last three decades looking into high-level assassinations, false flag events, and other activities of the deep state all over the world. And one of his recent discoveries is the existence of a CIA-linked assassination ring called Operation 40. Operation 40 is tied into the Kennedy assassinations here in the United States and many other high-level political assassinations abroad. It recalls what John Perkins revealed in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, that if he didn't manage to strong-arm countries and force their leaders to obey the international banksters, the banksters would send in the asteroids, otherwise known as the jackals. These are the high-level professional assassins, and it appears that at the very top of that profession is Operation 40. Well, Ole Domegaard has discovered new information tying in Operation 40 to yet another political assassination, this time in Portugal. So let's get it on. Welcome, Ole Domegaard. Tell us about how a little bit of background info on your investigation into Operation 40, and then we'll move on to this new stuff on Portugal.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me on, Kevin. The thing is, if we go back in history just to see the background of this group, it was under the eyes of President Dwight Eisenhower that the task was given to Vice President Nixon from people in the military industrial complex, the CIA and so on. They gave him the task to put together an ultra-secret team of assassins that could be used, just like John Perkins described it, to wherever they needed to just go in and eliminate people right, left, and center, whoever was in the way, either it was foreign leaders or politicians or double agents or whoever they needed to get rid of, they could just have this tool in the back pocket. So Richard Nixon, he got together some of the old wolves from the CIA. There were people like David Attlee Phillips, the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, and many other major assassins. Not that Oswald was not one of those, but the patsy there. You had Ted Shackley, the blonde ghost, very central in many assassinations globally.
And let me just stop you with Ted Shackley, because David Korn is a supposed left-wing alternative journalist who is much ballyhooed in The Nation magazine. They used David Korn to attack the 9/11 truth movement, and then in response received the biggest flood of letters ever in the history of The Nation magazine, every single one of them, 100% of them being pro-9/11 truth. Well, David Korn is constantly wheeled out to attack so-called conspiracy theorists, and he co-authored with Ted Shackley the autobiography of Ted Shackley called Blonde Ghost, celebrating this drug smuggling, Kennedy killing maniac. You know, this is such a classic case of how the so-called alternative media, the foundation-funded non-alternative media like The Nation magazine, is actually in the hands of the bad guys.
Yep, it sure does. And Ted Shackley, I mean, he was later director for covert operation for the whole Western Hemisphere. I mean, this was not an amateur. He was big time a CIA player. He was also very, very central in the whole Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, where they mass murdered people in many different areas. So Ted Shackley is very central in this whole thing.
So why would The Nation magazine lionize him? Why would they use David Korn, who's a big fan of Ted Shackley? I mean, isn't that sick?
I mean, many times when I look from the outside, I get very surprised by how, I would say, stupid they act, many of these people. But it's almost like they know that they, they're normal people, us, and then there's the elite. And as long as they follow their orders, they're fine, you know, they're on the safe side, they won't be attacked by anyone and so on. And so I think sometimes they even forget who they're, you know, approaching. So they forget about what we and normal people are not supposed to know. So sometimes they just pump it out there right in our face.
Yeah. Well, I just get frustrated because so many of my friends who are sort of left-leaning, you know, they think that they're dissidents, and yet they read The Nation magazine and think that it's actually honest information. They don't realize it's just more propaganda designed to brainwash people like them. Anyway, go on. Tell us more about Operation 40 and these CIA-linked assassins.
You know, when it comes to information, I say listen to all, follow none, and make up your own opinion. Use your own mind And also because many people, they reveal themselves by their actions and who they're supporting. In this case, it's very clear that this guy could not be trusted, I say, if he's even the co-author of Ted Shackley's book. I mean, anyway, so what they did was they got hold of George Herbert Walker Bush. That's George Bush Sr. He was the paymaster for this group of assassins. He was a very young man at that time, and he funneled the funds into this group. What they did then, they went down to Miami and they started recruiting mostly exiled Cubans, everything from the former police force and the Batista regime to the people around Fidel Castro and so on, because the first aim for this weapon was to eliminate Fidel Castro. That was the first task they were given. They failed on that one. But then after the missile crisis, suddenly Kennedy became a major problem for them, and they turned this cannon against him instead. So many of the shooters in Dili Plaza identified as members of this Operation 40. Now, this Operation 40 was created, like I said, late 50s, early 60s, and it consisted of about 80 people to start with, around 80 men and one woman. Her name was Marita Lawrence. And about out of these 80, there was about 20-odd that was actual assassins. The other ones was used to infiltrate or gather information or do whatever needed. And then, just like you said, John Perkins were describing, if needed, then they had the hammer to sort of just eliminate people with. And so I've looked into this, and I've been able to connect assassinations like Robert Kennedy, JFK, the Che Guevara assassination, Bob Marley, he was assassinated, John Lennon, you had Robert Smith in South Africa, you have Orlando Letier, they blew him up in Washington, D.C. They were part of overthrowing Salvador Allende in Chile, murdering him as well. They killed Pablo Neruda, the famous poet in Chile as well.
Really? You know, we should talk about that sometime, because can you quickly give us the summary of how they killed Pablo Neruda?
Pablo Neruda was, when they do these overtakes, one of the major problems they have are with poets or actors or in the arts, painters and so on, because they can become like a symbol for resistance. So this is often the people they aim at to start with, to get rid of authors, poets and so on.
Right, you mentioned John Lennon and Bob Marley already.
Yeah, exactly. And Pablo Neruda was this amazing poet. He was even given the Nobel Prize. So what they did was they tried to eliminate him, didn't succeed, and then he was taken into hospital one day for some minor thing. But at this hospital, when nobody noticed, there was a doctor that came in there and gave him an injection that he knew. When this happened, that he had been poisoned, and he tried to call for people saying, they're killing me, they're killing me. But then, they couldn't save him, and he died. There's been a lot of mysteries around this doctor that came in and so on, but as far as I've been able to identify, his real name is Michael Vernon Townley. He was part of the assassination on Olof Palme later on. He was part of many, many, many assassinations. And his controller was David Attlee Phillips, out of Operation 40.
Jeez.
So that's
your tax money at work, folks. The CIA's cultural program eliminating our greatest poets.
Yeah, it's very sad, very, very sad. But one of the new things I've come up with is that one of the members in this group, his name was Frank Sturgis, or Frank Fiorini, very, very violent mercenary, I mean a soldier of fortune who spent more or less his whole life fighting anti-Cuban or Cuban interests. He was trying to get rid of Castro, and he was working together with the CIA in many, many different operations, undercover and so on. And one of the latest things that I managed to connect him with is the assassination of the Portugal prime minister and defense ministers. These two people were blown up in a small little Cessna on December 4, 1980. That was just a few days before the killing of John Lennon as well. If you look, there's some years like 1980, 1986 and so on, where they were extremely intense, you know, very short intervals between the different hits they did and so on. This whole thing was Frank Sturgis, only the one that delivered the bomb that was, that was put in the plane, that blew up the plane. But in this whole thing are very, very strong connections to the whole Iran gate thing. Oliver North was directly involved in these two assassinations as well as Frank Carlucci from the Carlyle Group. He was an ambassador in Lisbon, from 1977, I think. 1975 to 77. And then he went straight from there, from being an ambassador, to become deputy director of the CIA. So that tells you quite a lot as well. Wow. So the thing was with these two, the Prime Minister, Francisco Caniero, was his name, and the Defense Minister, they were looking very much into some very shady businesses going on in Portugal at the time, because it seemed like Israel was using Portugal as sort of like a middle station for weapons going into the Iran-Iraq war. And so there was a lot of these arms dealings and arms trading going on in many different European countries. This is also where many of these assassinations, including Olof Palme, were connected to these arms deals. And quite a few of them are pointing directly back at Oliver North as well. He is like a spider in this web.
Very interesting. When you see Oliver North on Fox News, keep in mind he's not only a drug dealer, but he's an assassin as well.
It is. He's not doing the dirty work. He's the guy giving the order or following the orders. You know. Right. He's just one of. It's like Chip Tatum. He describes him as not in very nice words. That he's very coward and devious man that is involved in very, very many awful, awful things around the world.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the background of these assassinations in Portugal. What was the motive? You're suggesting that there's an arms dealing connection here. Were these Portuguese officials who were assassinated planning to blow the whistle on illegal arms shipments, or what was going on there?
As far as I know, is that the prime minister, he was digging into this, trying to find out what was going on, and they were being very threatened about him nosing around in things that he should have stayed out. But you have to know that this time, it was just the time when there was so much going on, you know, with Jimmy Carter, the hostage in Iran, Ronald Reagan taking over together with George Bush in the background, and these things. And they could not afford that somebody blew the whistle on them at that point. So they really needed to shut down everyone who was trying to expose them.
Could it have had something to do with the October Surprise? There have been Gary Sick and Barbara Honegger have written books on the October Surprise. Barbara's was first and best, and then Gary Sick plagiarized her and kind of watered it down a little bit. He did come on my show. I shouldn't say he plagiarized her. That's what Barbara says. I don't know that, but anyway. Yeah, he's been on my show. He's not very enthusiastic about reminding people that he wrote that book because it's a very taboo subject. But in any case, the bottom line here was that there was a coup d'etat. President Jimmy Carter was overthrown by a coup d'etat, and they did it by intentionally making sure that the Iranians would keep the U.S. hostages locked up until after the election. Had the hostages been freed, then Carter would have been reelected for sure. But because they weren't freed, every night the media was pumping out, this is day, 312 of the captivity of the poor hostages, et cetera, et cetera. And basically what happened was Bush and Casey of the CIA, and Bush being, of course, Reagan's VP candidate, cut a deal with the Iranians to keep the hostages locked up. And then they were, in fact, released just minutes after Reagan was sworn in. This was a coup d'etat, and it was treason. They should have hanged all of those people. You know, most of the Reagan-Bush administration, the Bush people, should all have been hanged for treason. And so that was an explosive issue. And as I recall, there was a connection with Spain and Portugal that some Casey and Bush fly through. Was it Spain or Portugal? I forget. Anyway, could that have been connected?
I don't know. I don't know for sure, but I know exactly what you described there with the whole thing with the hostage. Everything that is totally correct. And I mean, just like the whole thing, it was on his inauguration that the hostage were released. So it was like a big PR stunt, the whole thing. But these poor people, the hostage, I mean, who could have known or even figured out in their wildest imagination that they were held there against the Iranian will? They wanted to get rid of them as well, send them back home, but they were paid off to keep them. So
right, and the Iranians were desperate at that time, of course, because they were trying to stave off the Iraqi invasion. And every country, you know, all the major Western countries led by the U.S. were supporting the Iraqis, had armed the Iraqis, and you know, ended up giving them chemical weapons and told the Iraqis to attack Iran to strangle the Islamic Revolution in its cradle. So the Iranians were just absolutely desperate, and they had all kinds of American equipment from the Shah's era that needed spare parts and maintenance, and the only way they could get that was through cutting this deal. So, you know, we shouldn't be too harsh on the Iranians for doing this, but you know what it really amounted to was high treason by the Bush people in the United States. And you know, we've seen one Bush connected coup d'etat after another, from Watergate, which Russ Baker has revealed was a Bush crime family coup d'etat, to the October surprise coup d'etat that overthrew President Carter, to, well, of course, the JFK assassination was also a Bush family coup d'etat. H.W. Bush was involved in that as well. And then 9/11, of course, being yet another coup d'etat. So frankly, I'm a little concerned that if Jeb Bush ever takes over as president of the United States, we might see yet another coup d'etat. It could be worse than any of the other ones. But anyway, take us back to Portugal.
No, it's just the Bush name keeps popping up again and again and again and again. I mean, if you want to see a super, super, super criminal, you look at George Bush Sr. I mean, what he's been involved in is just incredible, I would say, over the decades, absolutely incredible. And unfortunately, it includes most of the Bush family. Jeb Bush is not, you know, he looks very nice and so on, but I know for sure that Barry Seal, that was one of the pilots for Operation 40, and who was later murdered with George Bush's phone number still in his pocket. And he was murdered just when he was about to give evidence, affidavit against George Bush Sr. He was murdered just 1 week before the Swedish prime minister that had just months before that said, or given the finger to Oliver North regarding some arms deals and so on. So they were just the first in a long row. But Jeb Bush, according to Barry Seal, he delivered some of the drugs that were involved in the Iran-Contras. He delivered it to, I think it was Miami in Florida, and the people receiving them personally was Jeb Bush and George Bush Jr. Then after Barry Seal was assassinated, the very plane that he flew that day was a beautiful twin engine. I can't remember the exact model, but that exact plane later turned up in the possession of George Bush Jr.
A trophy,
that exact plane,
skull and bones type of trophy. For all we knew, he went and dug up Barry Seal's index finger or something. And you know, these people are really sick. And Jeb Bush, by the way, flew in to the alleged hijacker training airstrips in Florida on 9/11. Maybe it was the next day. It was just hours after 9/11. Jeb Bush and his private handpicked bunch of so-called National Guard mafia gunmen, you know, thugs. The Bush flew in there to Hollywood, Florida, and what was the other town in Florida where these drug import airstrips were, you know, CIA drug import airstrips disguised as flight schools had pretended to train the alleged 19 hijackers. So Bush and his thugs flew in there. Under color of law, Florida governor flies in and seizes all the records of the CIA drug import airstrips that had supposedly been the places where these alleged hijackers had pretended to learn to fly. It's just amazing that these criminals are still getting away with it. We know all this stuff. It's part of the public record. And yet Jeb Bush is being groomed to run for president. It's just beyond surreal.
I don't get it. I really do not understand how this is possible. It feels like sometimes I'm living in sort of like a surrealistic LSD trip where everything is just, you know, like, I don't get it. I mean, how much evidence is needed before people start waking up?
Indeed.
And when it comes to, you know, we talked about Oliver Bush, Oliver North a little while ago. Chip Tatum, he claims that he heard when Bush Sr. gave the order to eliminate Barry Seal, and that order was given to Oliver North. Oliver North then headed the team of assassins that took him out.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's yet another one.
Yeah.
And I tell you, another one that Chip told me was that he overheard Ted Shackley say that they dumped the body of JFK to sea, over sea, you know, in the water, in the sea. They got rid of the evidence once and for all. He overheard Ted Shackley say that.
Well, that would explain why the president's brain is missing, why the autopsy photos are blatant forgeries, and so on.
Sorry, did I say Chip Tatum? I meant James Files, the shooter from the grassy knoll. I'm sorry, I mixed that up.
James Files, okay.
It was James Files. He overheard him say that.
Huh.
So, well,
crazy stuff.
It's just incredible, mind-blowing stuff when you get into it.
Right. So you have sources who are giving you this stuff. How do you vet your sources?
It's always very difficult. It is always very difficult to know. But I try to. If I can get it confirmed from two or three sources, hopefully, then I go open with it. But many times when it's historical things, you just need to see to the best of your ability how you can trust like different authors, researchers, and sort of stuff like that. And that it is a tricky one, but I try to put the jigsaw together the best I can, and then only present valid information.
Right. So we still haven't really fully covered the motive of these Portuguese assassinations, or maybe we just don't really know the full motive. Is that it?
It is still a mystery in Portugal. I mean, this is more than it's like 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, but it's still a mystery there. So I'm scraping on the surface, but I've been able to identify, because some people that were involved in it, one of them has come forward and he's naming Frank Sturgis and Frank Carlucci, Oliver North, as being involved in it. But I'll be most happy to come when I know more about it. I just wanted to get it out there so that people would start looking into this one as well, because this is a major thing, you know.
Is there any chance that a Portuguese court would be willing to issue indictments or to at least investigate this?
We're back to if the government is not corrupt, they should be going for it right away. But nowadays, unfortunately, on so many different levels, in so many different countries, there's such corruption and such fear of getting anywhere close to these matters.
Right.
So officially, I think, I don't know, officially I think that they should have done things a long time ago, because this has been apparently been knowledge that has been known and published in Portugal, and they've had like official hearings and so on, and journalists have been invited, and you know, given testimony about these things, but still nothing, absolutely nothing happens. Now Frank Sturgis is dead. He was just before his 69th birthday, he was part of planning another invasion of Cuba. And he got like a mosquito bite on his back, and he went to the doctor to see what it was, and then he was dead in a few days later.
No, what year was that?
Cancer. They sorry?
No, what year was that?
I'm not really sure. Not that many years ago. I can find out. But he was very fit, you know, but he was buried on his 69th birthday instead of celebrating it.
One of those cancer mosquito bites, I guess. Probably one of the same mosquitoes that they sent after Hugo Chavez.
Could be, because he was like, there was no diagnosis of cancer, nothing, but that is the official cause of death. But it was this bite on the back that's the only one. And then there was no autopsy. He was buried right away, boom, boom, and case closed. Nobody has looked into it.
An awful lot of these people end up meeting unnatural ends. It's funny, they spend their lives killing others, and then it comes around and gets them.
It's like the old gunslingers, you know, you live by the gun, you die by the gun. I think there's nothing new under the sun. This is the way it goes. They live very violently. They are very brutal, and they die in brutal ways, most of them.
Wow. Well, you know, we only have a minute or two left here, but do you see any progress towards exposing all of this in such a way that the public might decide to do something about it, you know, find a better way to guard the guardians? I mean, these people are basically the self-appointed guardians that Plato talked about, that think that they're the ones who are, you know, going to save us from foreign and domestic enemies. Of course, they run around and just assassinate all of these enemies, but they're not really guarding us. They're guarding their own power. So who will guard the guardians? How are we going to find somebody who can guard these guardians, Ole?
It's up to us. We have to do it. You know, but one thing is, a part of it is waking up to the fact of what is going on. And because many of them are absolute no-brainers when you look into it. It is so obvious what has been done, but still people buy into it for some very strange reason. I don't get it. You know, like Robert Kennedy, 14 shots fired. Sirhan had 8 bullets in a revolver. After 2 shots, people jumped him, got rid of his gun, and still they claim 1 shooter. He was all the time standing right in front of Robert Kennedy, shooting straight at him. But Kennedy was hit by 3 bullets right from the back and to the right. Mm-hmm. I mean, point blank, there were even burnt holes in his clothes and his in his hair because it was so close. And still, people are like, no, it was Sirhan.
Right. 14 shots when he actually fired 2 from a gun that only holds 6 bullets. You know, that's worse than 2 planes causing 3 buildings to turn into powder at free fall acceleration. You know, do the math, people.
No, there were eight shots in his revolver. He fired all of them. But after 2 shots, they jumped and he kept firing. And there were 5 other people wounded around Kennedy. But all the 3 shots that hit him was straight from the back and to the right. But still, so in my, you know, like if I say to my kid, you know, have a look at this one, he will say right away, there's 2 shooters at least. But no. The official story stands.
Well, we're hoping that William Pepper will help break that one open. William Pepper's the guy who got the jury verdict that proved that the U.S. federal government, including the Army, the FBI, and CIA, with their organized crime assets, killed Dr. Martin Luther King. So maybe Bill Pepper will make some progress with this one, too. He's been working on the Sirhan case. I hope to have him back on the show at some point talking about that. Well, Ole, I think we've hit the end of our allotted half hour. Give us the website is
lightonconspiracies.com.
Lightonconspiracies.com. Well, keep up the great work, Ole Damegaard. Look forward to the next update. And until then, stay safe.
You too. Thank you so much.
Bye bye.
Take care. Bye.
John Colombo was my friend. He was a cab driver. He drove around town. He took people places all across the city. Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo? Who killed John Colombo?